from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. concern over the crisis in Yemen. Obama calls for peaceful elections in Nigeria. An overfishing opponent wins the prize. And a new social media scare over the Internet of Things.
That makes everything convenient, sure, but it also gives the bad guys that many more ways to hack your stuff.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States, having evacuated its last personnel from the Yemen capital, Sana'a, acknowledged Monday the security situation in the country is grave. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf says further violence would be catastrophic, but downplays the degree of influence Iran has over the Shiite Houthi rebels.
But we are being very clear that all parties in Yemen need to immediately halt all unilateral and offensive military actions, return to Yemen's political transition, have urged a commitment to peaceful political transition consistent with the GCC initiative, the national dialogue outcomes. There are a number of ways they could get back to dialogue here. Obviously, that's what we believe needs to happen. When it comes to Iran, obviously we're aware of reports of a variety of support that Iran has provided to the Houthis, but have not seen evidence that Iran is exerting command and control over their activities in Yemen. So I think it's just a little different than maybe the link you were trying to draw. Obviously, though, the security situation is very concerning.
At the White House, spokesman Josh Earnest said Monday there continues to be ongoing security cooperation between the United States and the national security infrastructure of the government of President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi.
That will continue to be valuable coordination. The United States continues to have assets and resources in the region that will allow us to take steps where necessary to continue to apply significant pressure to extremist targets and to keep the American people safe. But it is true that that coordination would be more effective if there were U.S. personnel in the country. It doesn't mean that that coordination has been eliminated, but it would be more effective if U.S. personnel were allowed to remain in that country. That is why the United States will continue to support the broader international community as we pressure both sides to try to resolve their differences politically and to promote the kind of dialogue that's necessary to stabilize the country, to stabilize the central government.
Saudi Arabia's foreign minister warned Monday his government and its Gulf neighbors would take the necessary measures to protect the region from Iranian aggression. At the same time, Yemen's foreign minister called for Gulf Arab military intervention to halt Houthi advances toward the southern port of Aden. Middle East analyst Stephen Zunes of the University of San Francisco tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Houthis represent only one segment of Yemeni society, but says they are taking advantage of societal divisions to press their demands.
The actor that has not been given enough attention and support has been Yemeni civil society, which emerged in a massive, nonviolent, broad-based pro-democracy struggle in 2011, forcing the downfall of the long-standing Western-backed dictator Saleh. But unfortunately, negotiations for his replacement, which were led by Saudi Arabia with U.S. support, brought in his vice president as essentially the only candidate. And the real reforms that people were demanding really did not come through. Civil society was not part of the transition negotiations in the transition process. And whenever you have any country where civil society is marginalized and bypassed, especially when they've been mobilized and were as hopeful as they were just a few years ago, it creates a vacuum where men with guns end up having an inordinate amount of influence, and that's exactly what we're seeing in Yemen today.
The Shia militia moving south, if they capture Aden, what would that mean?
That would basically, you know, put the country under their control. Obviously, capturing the capital was quite significant, but being able to control the principal port and economic center would be a degree of wielding power that would make it very much more difficult to reverse. They don't have much support in that part of the country, however. Not only do you have loyalists of the officially recognized government, but you have strong regional forces there. that I think would resist it. I would be very surprised to see the Houthis being able to capture Aden. But frankly, to be honest, I was surprised that they were able to capture Sana'a, the capital. So it's a very fluid situation. It's really hard to predict.
The top diplomat in Yemen Monday said Washington and its allies need to make some decisions quickly to preserve the possibility of a political solution to the crisis in Yemen. Is there a political solution possible in Yemen?
The only real political solution, I think, at least in the long term, would be to include civil society, include the broad-based pro-democracy movement, the leading political parties, not just leave it to the Houthis, to the supporters of the previous dictatorship, traditional elites in the military and the like, unless the people of Yemen believe there is a government that is truly representative of them, it will only make it possible for the armed groups, whether they be the Houthis or extremist Sunni groups allied with al-Qaeda and ISIS, they will end up playing a much bigger role than they should.
Zun says Gulf Arab intervention could have the opposite effect of increasing support for the Houthis and other extremist elements in Yemen. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling for free and fair elections in Nigeria this Saturday and for Nigerians to reject the violence that has marred the country's previous polls. In a video released Monday by the U.S. Embassy in Abuja, President Obama said successful elections are key to stopping insurgent group Boko Haram and allowing more than a million displaced Nigerians to return to their homes. Reporter Peter Cloti in Abuja Monday spoke about the balloting with VOA's Michael Lippin.
What do the latest polls say about the presidential race between Goodluck Jonathan and Muhammadu Buhari, and how reliable are such polls?
Now, there's only one significant poll that came out that was against the grain, and it was done by Kevin, Charlene, and Kimberly Associates, a UK-based research and political risk consultancy firm, that stated that incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan of the PDP, or the People's Democratic Party, will win the 2015 presidential election, that is this Saturday, with a margin of 13%. That is the only poll that goes against the grain. All the polls show a 50-50 toss-up poll election. However, this particular polling group said that Jonathan was going to win 13% with 13% advantage. Now, the opposition has outrightly rejected this poll, said that it was sanctioned or paid for by the PDP to sway momentum on its side, because before the election was postponed, the PDP basically was on the ropes. After the election was postponed, the PDP appeared to have come back very strong, especially even in the north of Kano, where Buhari ostensibly holds a very big majority. Now, the PDP is showing some strong signs, and officials of the APC, or the Opposition All Progressive Congress, have admitted that even the PDP is showing some form of life in the north, where it has its significant base.
Now, what has been the reaction in Nigeria today to the video statement by President Barack Obama appealing to all candidates not to engage in violence or incitement?
Both parties welcomed it. And when I spoke with them earlier today, they all referred me to an agreement that both President Goodluck Jonathan, the incumbent, and the opposition leader, General Retired Muhammadu Buhari, signed a few weeks back, promising to ensure that their supporters do not engage in acts of violence that could undermine the integrity of the election or destabilize the country. So they both welcome President Obama's video message.
Another development today was a Nigerian court ruling that President Jonathan cannot deploy the military to secure the elections. What prompted this ruling, and how much does it increase the risk that polling stations will not be secure if soldiers can't be physically near those locations?
Well, what prompted the court to make the ruling was because an opposition party took the matter to court, because they have been expressing concern that they have uncovered a plot by the ruling PDP to deploy security agencies, including the military and the police and other security groups, to intimidate and harass or rig the election. And that is why they took it to court. They are afraid that PDP will use the military, or for that matter, the security agencies, to rig the vote. However, it remains to be seen how the election will be secured, because the police are the first point of call. However, in areas where insecurity abounds, the military is usually deployed to help stabilize the region. Now, one of the reasons why also that they took the matter to court was because in Ekiti, during the gubernatorial election a couple of months back, the APC complained that the military was heavily used to intimidate, arrest, and harass opponents of the ruling party. And that forced the APC to basically crumble, and the PDP won that gubernatorial election. So they think, and they named it Ekiti Gate. They think if the military is once again deployed for the presidential election nationwide, that is a mark that the PDP would win the election. But they also said that looking at the six geopolitical zones in the country, four is firmly on their side, and only two. So they do not see any reason why President Goodluck Jonathan can win re-election. And this is where the problem lies.
Reporter Peter Clody in Abuja. U.S. President Obama has announced nearly $250 million in new pledges to support the study of science, technology, engineering, and math, a group of fields jointly called STEM. At the White House Science Fair Monday, the president stressed the importance of private sector efforts to encourage more students from underrepresented groups to pursue science studies. He told the audience the young inventors have something to teach us all.
These young scientists and engineers teach us something beyond the specific topics that they're exploring. They teach us how to question assumptions, to wonder why something's the way it is and how we can make it better. And they remind us that there's always something more to learn and to try and to discover and to imagine, and that it's never too early or too late to create or discover something new.
President Obama said the United States must encourage more young people to engage in scientific innovation.
5 years ago, we launched a campaign called Educate to Innovate to help more of our students explore science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, I'm pleased to announce $240 million in new contributions from businesses, from schools, from foundations across the country to help kids learn in these STEM fields.
President Obama said no young person should miss out on the opportunity to excel in science because of a lack of funds. A supporter of a controversial way to prevent overfishing has won a major environmental prize. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
Jane Lubchenco supported programs known as Catch Shares when she headed the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration from 2009 to 2013. Catch Shares set a maximum amount of fish that can be caught in a region, then divide the allowed catch among fishermen. Proponents say they stop a race to the bottom, in which fishermen try to catch as much as possible without regard for the future of the fishery. With Catch Shares, fishermen's takes increase as the fishery recovers and grows. Lubchenco credits these programs with restoring fish populations in the United States.
From 2000 to 2013, we went from having 92 overfished stocks to 40. And we went from having zero rebuilt stocks to 34. It gives us incredible hope that we can replicate those successes elsewhere and really end overfishing at the global scale.
Critics say these programs can drive small fishermen out of the market and raise barriers to people just getting started in the industry. 17 U.S. fisheries are in Catch Shares programs, and more are in development. Lubchenco will share the $200,000 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement with Madhav Godgill of India's Goa University, who drew praise for engaging local communities in environmental protection. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
One of the biggest growth areas in technology these days isn't home computers or smartphones, but what is being called the Internet of Things. Roughly speaking, the Internet of Things are all those devices that aren't computers but can wirelessly connect to the web. These things include home heating systems, closed circuit cameras, industrial machinery, door locks, just to name a few. It's estimated there's already nearly 3 billion such devices connected to the Internet, all designed to make life more convenient. But are they also making our lives less secure? VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard has been looking into the Internet of Things and joins me now. Hey, Doug.
Hey there, Susan.
What have you been learning?
Well, just in case you were getting comfortable with the web, here comes the Internet of Things to mess everything up again. Now, Susan, think back. I remember certainly growing up reading science fiction stories about the house of tomorrow, where they would promise the kitchen that would clean itself and remember to make your favorite cup of coffee in the morning. The truth is, that was science fiction then, but it's not far from the mark now. Today we have all of these, quote, smart things. Smart lights, smart TVs, ovens, cars, refrigerators. Once they connect to the Internet, they're really no different than your home computer or your tablet. So that makes everything convenient, sure, but it also gives the bad guys that many more ways to hack your stuff. Now, I recently spoke with Candid West. He's a principal threat researcher at the security firm Symantec. West and his team have been looking at hundreds of these devices, and he says nearly every one that they found had major security flaws, if not outright holes. Now, Susan, can you guess what the most common flaw was?
No.
Passwords, namely a total lack of passwords, or frankly, not much better, just discarding the requirements for users to authenticate themselves.
It's very kind of devastating and actually even shocking to see that we still see so many devices with no proper authentication implemented. So for many of the devices that we looked at, we actually saw that once you deploy them in your Wi-Fi at home, so in your network that you probably use for your laptops and smartphones as well, they don't require any additional authentication.
So now, just to make this story perhaps a little creepier, here's just one example. West and his team say they found a fairly basic security flaw with a popular smart door lock. Now, using that flaw, he says, they could have, if they wanted, unlocked thousands of locked doors across the United States with just one command.
That's unsettling, and it reminds me of a story. My brother lived in a housing development where all the garages were the same, and they had a real problem with thieves because they would get these automatic door openers for the garages, and they'd drive around and find a house that was dark, and then they'd open their garage and they'd go in and steal whatever they could find. And it was the same idea.
Exactly. As an exploit, it's really not much different.
Yes. It's all worrying, but I have to think there has to be some way to secure all these smart things that are living on the Internet. Who's to blame for all this mess?
Well, now, West says that the blame really can be spread around. Now, on the user side, he noted that once people often got their devices all hooked up and working, even if it did offer robust security and privacy protection, hardly anyone ever bothered to use it. And, you know, that's very much in keeping with the kind of things that we've been talking about for a long time. People should change their passwords, but they don't. People should update their software, but they don't. So, again, some of the blame does land on us users. But West told us that the majority of devices that they examined don't have even the most rudimentary password settings or protections against what are now some very common hacks, computer hacks, that people have known about and been able to protect against for more than a decade. So that's on the manufacturers. So West has concluded that all of the security lessons that we learned 10 years ago or more, both on the user side and the manufacturer side for our computers, we're apparently going to have to relearn again for the Internet of Things.
It seems like history is repeating. We see the same mistakes like the web vulnerabilities or not using passwords at all being repeated, and these are things that we've seen for more than 10 years. So the question for us is, are the manufacturers not doing it because the users are requesting it? And if so, maybe the users should actually start asking for more security.
So what are you saying here? Is everything okay, or do I now have to be afraid of my toaster and my coffee maker and everything else?
Well, if you're afraid of your coffee maker, I don't know if I have counsel on that one.
I think you should be worried about my coffee.
I have not had your coffee, so I can't talk on that. But seriously, the more personal a device is, the more caution it's recommended to exercise. Now, that's a lesson, if I can just share this one story, that Heather and Adam Schreck of Cincinnati, Ohio, learned last year. So they had one of those baby monitors on their newborn's crib. It's the kind that lets you watch and even talk to your child from a computer wherever you're away. They didn't update their camera's software to patch a security flaw. The result was that one night they discovered that some unknown person was watching and talking to their baby, and they still have no idea who it was or how long it was
going
on.
That's really scary.
Very scary.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by as usual.
My job is done.
Thanks. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard right here in our Washington studios. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You'll get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 24th, 1707, the Acts of Union was signed, officially uniting the kingdoms of England and Scotland and creating Great Britain. In 1832, a Hiram, Ohio mob tarred and feathered Mormon leader Joseph Smith. Smith survived the attack. The reason for the violence is disputed, but many believe it was due to controversy surrounding a romance that Smith had with a local woman. In 1934, the United States Congress passed the Tidings-McDuffie Act, mapping out a process by which the Philippines would become an independent nation. In 1958, rock and roll pioneer Elvis Presley was inducted into the U.S. Army. On this day in 1976, the president of Argentina, Isabel Perón, was deposed by the country's military in a bloodless coup. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 24th, nations around the globe will observe World Tuberculosis Day, commemorating Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that caused the disease. The observance is designed to build public awareness about the global epidemic of tuberculosis. TB is the second leading cause of death from infectious diseases worldwide, infecting almost 9 million people and killing some 1.3 million. Prior to the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, tuberculosis, or TB, was one of the most feared diseases around. The majority of TB deaths occur in the developing world, where the disease is closely linked to poverty, marginalized and vulnerable populations, substandard housing, and poor nutrition. The fight to eliminate TB has seen tremendous progress over the past quarter century, with a 45% decline in mortality since 1990 and the emergence of new technologies, such as fast-acting diagnostics for use in low- and middle-income countries, and which was developed with funding from the U.S. government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the World Health Organization. Despite the availability of effective treatment for many decades, TB remains a major global health problem. Today, TB's global incidence rate is falling slowly. Five of the six WHO regions of the world are on track to meet the UN Millennium Development Goal of halving TB prevalence and deaths by the end of 2015. The United States is committed to fighting TB. In focusing our efforts in countries where the burden of TB is highest, we support programs that save lives and foster a more secure world. Across the federal government, we have made this fight a priority. We are the first and largest single contributor to the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, having donated over $5 billion to the Global Fund since its inception in 2002. The United States continues to partner with the World Health Organization, or WHO, the Stop TB Partnership, and the Global Drug Facility, all of which provide important support for TB control activities worldwide. While these developments are encouraging, the fight to eliminate TB requires continued strong engagement and commitment by governments and communities, public and private health care providers, people in affected communities, and TB patients themselves. By joining in a global commitment to stop the spread of TB, we can begin to free a new generation from an ancient affliction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.